Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here is Bob.
We're continuing our study in 2 Kings. We're going to be in chapter 21, which is the life and reign of Manasseh. Now, Manasseh is the child that Hezekiah wanted, but never had up until that great sickness where the prophet Isaiah told him he was going to die. And Hezekiah turned his face to the wall and prayed, and God let him have 15 more years. Well, several years into that extended period, Manasseh, his first male son, was born. Now, Manasseh confuses some folks because it's the name of Joseph's elder son and also the name of this Judean king. But now, the Manasseh, much earlier, is one of the half-tribes, okay? Ephraim and Manasseh, the two sons of Joseph, back in Genesis. But this is Manasseh that is the son of Hezekiah. Now, the word Manasseh means causing forgetfulness. Well, we think it was something related to the life of Hezekiah, like he had forgotten his pain at being sonless or something like that. Well, not real sure. The fuller parallel of this is in 2 Chronicles 33. It needs to be read to fully understand 2 Kings 21. They're the same, but they're different. 2 Kings deals more with a national perspective. Chronicles deals more with a personal perspective to some extent. Now, notice what it says. Manasseh was 12 years old when he became king, and he reigned 55 years in Jerusalem. He has one of the longest reigns, matter of fact, the longest reign of any Hebrew king, 55 years. Long and mostly very, very evil. And his mother's name was Hephzibah, which means my delight is in her. There are probably, as you know, several women around the harem, and all of them were vying for attention, so the mother's name becomes very important. Now, we learned this 55-year reign is also recorded in 2 Chronicles 33:1 and from the writings of Josephus. Now, in verse 2, it says, "And he did evil in the sight of the Lord according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord dispossessed before the sons of Israel." Now, I want to tell you, God is a God of fairness, and he is no respecter of persons. In Genesis 15:16, God tells Abraham that his descendants will go into captivity, but he will bring them out and give them the promised land where Abraham had sojourned. Now, he says the reason he was going to give them the promised land is because of the sins of the Amorites, which is a collective term for all the tribes in that area. Now, what he's saying is that there is a particular sins of idolatry and wickedness that were going to come to fruition in the life of those tribes, and God's judgment would be to take them out of the land. Well, lo and behold, when God's people come into the land, the same type of sins begin to accumulate around their national and corporate existence. The very thing that God did to the Amorites in judgment, God does to the Hebrews in judgment. So God is no respecter of persons. He did the very same thing to the Hebrew people when they committed those horrendous, idolatrous sins of the Canaanites. Now, notice if you would in verse 3. "For he built high places, which Hezekiah his father had destroyed." Now, the high places, we know, were to the male fertility god Baal, which means master and lord. And he was probably the chief god of the Canaanite pantheon. His consort is going to be Asherah. And this is the emphasis on fertility worship, sexual orgies, the attempt by imitation magic to secure the fertility of the soil and of the population. Now, notice it says, "And he erected altars for Baal and made an Asherah." Now, this is probably a carved pole, as Baal was worshipped by an uplifted stone, some think in the shape of a phallus. But the female goddess was worshipped by a carved wooden pole. Now, because of Deuteronomy, let's see, I have that reference here. Deuteronomy 16:21, some think it was a live planted tree. Either one may be true, but I think it was a carved pole, okay? And Asherah would be the female consort. "As Ahab, king of Israel, had done, and worshipped all the host of heaven." Now, suddenly we're getting into a lot of titles here of deities. The host of heaven is a reference to the Babylonian astral worship. They would worship the planets, the five main planets known in that day, the sun and the moon, and the signs of the zodiac. And so here we have another foreign influence unto the people of Israel. Now, I have a graphic I would like to show you that lists some of these gods and practices that are listed in this chapter. So let's go to the graphic if we could. And you'll notice, please, that I've listed Baal, Ashtaroth, the host of heaven. And we're going to get in soon into, it doesn't say Molech in your text. It'll say pass through the fire. And then we have witchcraft and divination. And I'll talk about those specifically. But just look at the overview of the evil, idolatrous, occultic practices that Manasseh was involved in. It's almost amazing that a king of Judah could have a list of idolatries like that. Now, some of this is explainable in the fact that Manasseh, of course, is completely under the vassalage of the Assyrian king. And he had to bring the Assyrian gods into his temple and into his corporate life because he was a vassal. But this goes far beyond that. And so Manasseh is apparently repudiating the reforms of his father Hezekiah in bringing all of these foreign practices back into the cultic life of the people of God. Now, notice it says, the host of heaven and serve them. Now, you ought to see Deuteronomy 4:19 and Deuteronomy 17:3 for these altars that were put in the temple. Verse 4, and he built altars in the house of the Lord, of which the Lord had said, in Jerusalem I'll put my name. Now, that's a Deuteronomic phrase about the focusing worship into one central place, Jerusalem. Manasseh even built these foreign altars in the temple itself. Can you believe that? Now, notice in verse 5, for he built altars for the host of heaven in the two courts of the house of the Lord. I'm going to go one step further. Solomon's temple only had two courts, the court of the people and the court of the priest. He even built altars in the court of the priest, right next to the holy place and the great altar of sacrifice. There seemed to be nothing sacred to him. I'm sure he didn't understand that he was violating anything about Yahweh. I'm sure he just thought he was adding to. But lo and behold, it almost was like Yahweh was going to become the head of a new pantheon. Now, notice what it says in verse 6, and he made his sons pass through the fire. Now, this is the worship of the Phoenician fire god, Molech. Now, the Hebrew word for king is Melech, and so it's a corruption of the word for king. We learn of this god mostly from other places and other times, but apparently it was worshipped outside Jerusalem in the valley of the sons of Hinnom. Jesus called it Gehenna. This was his example of hell. When the Jews hated this god so much, they made this valley the garbage dump of Jerusalem. And apparently Manasseh offered some of his children to this fire god. And the other people brought their firstborn sons and rolled them into the belly of this bronze statue on fire. They would have, these children were apparently alive, and they would muffle the sounds of these screaming children by loud drum beats. God, help us. What has happened to the people of Israel? If you want to see a summary of this, there are several scriptures listed in your outline of where you can find Molech listed in Leviticus. Now, then it says, and practice witchcraft. Now, if you want to see a list of these sins, see Deuteronomy 18, verses 10 through 12. Now, I want to talk about each one of them because such occult practices are prevalent in our day, and they're nothing more than ancient things revived. Now, the word witchcraft comes from a word that means a cloud, or one who, by observing the clouds, can tell future events, can answer questions from the gods, can ascertain the will of the gods. And so it's a person who looks at natural phenomenon, particularly clouds, the flight of birds, to ascertain the will of God. Now, the word divination, this is a word that has a very similar meaning. There is a personal form of divination, which means talking to the dead or talking to the spirit world, and an impersonal form of divination, like the looking at the livers of animals, the flight of birds, dropping sticks in a certain way to make certain form. Reading tea leaves and palm readers in our day would be an impersonal form of divination, an attempt to understand the will of the gods or know the future by man's manipulation of things or watching the things of nature. Now, it says, and dealt with mediums. Now, the word medium is, of course, a form of personal divination where people are trying to contact the unseen spiritual realm. Now, the word here in Hebrew is literally the word bottle. Now, in the Septuagint translation, the Greek translation, they translate the word ventriloquist. And what we have here is someone who can control sounds. Now, we would think of a seance where people speak from beyond the grave, or quackings and jerkings and honkings occur. well, that be a person who could control that or manipulate that or call forth that. And so it'd be a mediumship. Then the word spiritist. Now, the Hebrew word here means knowing ones, and they also are much like mediums. They're always connected in the Old Testament. Apparently, it is someone who knows the art of mediumship on a high level, and they would be the wise ones or the knowing ones, okay? He did much evil on the side of the Lord, provoking him to anger. Then he set the graven image of Asherah. Now, if you'll look at verse 3 at what we're talking about, an idol right in the temple. It was this carved pole of the male fertility god of the Canaanite pantheon that he had made in the house which the Lord said to David and to his son Solomon. This is the house in Jerusalem which I have chosen from all the tribes of Israel to put my name. Now, what we have here in verse 8 is God trying to affirm what a horrendous, hideous violation of what God wanted this really was. Notice the condition in verse 8. If only they will observe to do according to all that I've commanded them. Now, friends, this is the conditional element of the Old Testament. When God makes a promise, it's unconditional. But it's conditional on every generation to embrace that unconditional promise. Manasseh is accused here of his horrendous sins of causing the exile. Even the godly Josiah later on won't be able to stem the tide, even with radical religious reform, because of Manasseh's evil. You ought to look at Deuteronomy 27 and 28, where God told them, if you'll keep my covenant, I'll bless you. If you break my covenant, I'll curse you. Now, friends, there's a great blessing knowing God, but turning away from God in the presence of great light is an awful, awful violation. Now, notice in verse 9, but they did not listen, the king and the people, and Manasseh seduced them into doing more evil than the nations whom the Lord destroyed before the sons of Israel. Manasseh seduced them. Religious leaders have great responsibility and obligations. Manasseh used his leadership to lure the people off into great sin and idolatry. Now, notice in verse 10 where it says, and the Lord spoke through his servants, the prophet, saying, because Manasseh, king of Judah, has done these abominations, having done wickedly more than all the Amorites. Now, the word Amorite is a collective term for all the Canaanite peoples, the Hivites, the Hittites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Geshites, the Jebusites. You all see Genesis 15, 16, collective term. He's going to dispossess them. In verse 12, he says it's going to be so bad that when people hear about it, their ears are going to tingle because of the judgment that comes on Judah. And I will stretch over Jerusalem the line of Samaria and the plummet of the house of Ahab. Now, this is an allusion to the destruction of the northern 10 tribes. Samaria is the capital of the northern 10 tribes that are now in exile somewhere in Media through the agency of Assyria. And so they're gone. And what God said is, what I did to them, I'm going to do to you. Now, the plummet is a construction tool of the ancients. It was a string with a large, some weight on the bottom where they could tell what a straight line is. And what God is saying is, I'm going to judge you. And you have been found crooked, and therefore you will be destroyed. Notice this last little metaphor. I will wipe Jerusalem as one wipes a dish, wiping it and turning it upside down. What he's saying is, I'm going to empty the place of the population. Oh, my goodness. And I will abandon the remnant of my inheritance. Now, the other tribes are gone. So Judah and Benjamin. Really, it's Judah, Benjamin, and Simeon, because he's disappeared too. But they call them the two tribes, and that's what the remnant is here. Notice in verse 15, because they've done evil in my sight, they've been provoking me to anger since the day their fathers came from Egypt, even today. You see, Manasseh was nothing new. Manasseh was the ultimate culmination of rebellious evil throughout their walk with God. The wilderness was evil. They were evil as they entered the promised land. They were evil in the period of the judges. They were evil through all the kings. They were evil people. And God says, finally, they're going to reap the harvest of their evil. They broke my covenant over and over and over again, and I'm going to judge them for it. Now, notice if you would in verse 16. Moreover, Manasseh shed very much innocent blood until he filled Jerusalem from one end to another. Now, tradition says that Manasseh is the one who killed Isaiah. Tradition says that he sawed him in two. There's an allusion to that in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 37 and following. Now, I'm sure he killed the true prophets to shut their mouth. I'm sure that he is involved in this child sacrifice, and maybe the innocent blood refers to those children offered to Molech in the Valley of Hinnom. But also, I'm sure there are many faithful, godly Judeans, and he killed them too. Friends, his hands ran red with the blood of loyal followers of God. Now, notice it says, which he made Judah sin. Our leaders have a great influence on us. They can walk us in the valley of death or lead us to the heights of fellowship with God. We're personally responsible, but too often we act like cattle and just follow people. Now, notice what it says in verse 17. Now, the rest of the acts of Manasseh and all that he did and his sin which he committed, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? Now, what's amazingly absent here, is that in 2 Chronicles 33, verse 11 through 19, Manasseh repents. Now, apparently it's related to him being taken captive in hooks to that foreign power of the Fertile Crescent of his day. But soon after that, he must have repented, turned to God, asked God to forgive him, remove the high places, took out the idols. But you see what happened. Even though Manasseh personally repented, the Jews used Manasseh as an example of the power of repentance. That if God can forgive an evil king like this, who led Israel into such depths of sin and idolatry, they say God can forgive anybody. And I agree, that's true. But another truth is here. Even though Manasseh personally turned to God, his influence wrecked the lives of a generation of people. Friends, there are people watching and are influenced by how we live. Now, notice what it says. Manasseh slept with his fathers, and he was buried in the garden of his own house, in the garden of Uzzah. Now, he was not buried with the other kings of Israel. They had a particular burial place for the kings of the lineage of David. He was not buried there. Why, we don't know. Some think it's related to the god by this name. I just don't know, but he was separated and buried there, and his son will be buried with him. The only two will be Amon and Manasseh, buried in this garden of Uzzah. Now, in verse 19, we pick up on his son, who was 22 years when he became king. Now, there are two possibilities of this name. It means to support, to help, something like that in Hebrew. But some think it's related to the Egyptian god Amnon of Thebes. Now, why would they think that this boy is related to the Egyptian? Friends, there is so much happening in the world right now that you're going to have to read a brief account of the history that we're dealing with. A History of Israel by John Bright is an awful good book to catch the history through here. Egypt is trying to assert influence this time. Assyria is on the way down. Babylon and Media are on the way up. And there is a real interchange in these next few chapters between these world empires and Israel. The land of Palestine is caught right in the middle. And the flow in it. Right now there's a pro-Egyptian influence. There's a pro-Assyrian influence. All of that is happening. There's even a pro-Babylonian influence. Remember Hezekiah's letter from the king of Babylon? All of these intrigues are happening in the royal house. Now, notice where it mentions his mother's name, and it means at peace or safe. And he's the daughter of, and the word there in Hebrew means industrious. Notice it says that he did evil in the sight of the Lord as Manasseh his father has done. For he walked in all the way that his father had walked and served the idols that his father had served. Now here we have an example that even though Manasseh may have repented, his son was drastically influenced by his father's idolatry. And the son did not turn, even though the father did. Now, in verse 22, it says, and he forsook the Lord, the God of the fathers, and did not walk in the way of the Lord. Now, these are two key Hebrew words, the way and walk. Walk emphasizes the truth that biblical faith is not so much a creed to believe or theology to master. It is not even an emotion. It is primarily a lifestyle based on our love for God. And so to say he walked not after his father's saying, he did not walk in those boundaries that God has given for his people, that they might be unique and be happy in the world. Now, the way, is an ancient idea of well-worn wagon tracks, or God has set us in a rut, if you please, to keep us happy and enjoying life. Now, in the New Testament, this well-worn way of life was the earliest name for the Christian movement. They were called the Way. Now, that ought to tell us that Christianity is primarily a relationship with Jesus Christ, a commitment followed by a lifestyle. It's so important. An initial decision followed by a lifestyle. An initial relationship followed by a lifestyle relationship. Now, in verse 23, and the servants of Amnon conspired against him and killed him in the king's own house. This is probably that pro-Egyptian faction again. Okay? Let's see. And the people of the land killed all those who had conspired against King Amnon. Now, the people of the land here is used in its normal sense in the Old Testament of the landed gentry, the politically powerful, the wealthy. They kill the conspirators. So this group would be very nationalistic oriented, very pro-Judah, and kill the pro-Egyptian group. Now, verse 25. Now the wrecks of the acts of Amnon, and which he did, are they not written in the book of Chronicles, the kings of Judah? And he was buried in his grave in the garden of Uzzah. There he is again. Only two. Manasseh in verse 18, and him. And Josiah his son became king in his place. Now next week we're going to be looking at the life of Josiah, one of the godliest kings ever in the Old Testament. And we'll be in chapter 23. So I hope in preparation of next week's lesson that you will read chapter 23. And kind of get yourself in the mood for us looking at it together. Now, I want to mention a book that I was going to talk about earlier and just forgot in the heat of the moment. A book that I think is very helpful for two reasons. Number one, it does a background of Hebrew words for English-speaking people. And it's highly indexed so that you can find certain words. When I was looking up the words witchcraft, medium, spiritist, divination, even when I looked in all of my Bible encyclopedias, and I have four or five sets, I really couldn't get a handle on what they were saying. But I found this one little paperback book was so very helpful. Now, it was written back in 1904, so it's a very old book, and it doesn't have all of the benefit of all of the modern archaeological discoveries. But as I have read it, I have found it to be accurate in most cases and very, very beneficial to me on what Hebrew words mean and how they relate to New Testament usages. Now, I want to show you one other thing, if I could. In the back of this book is a series, just look how many references there are, just page after page after page after page. Now, I want to give you a hint, please. If you buy a book like this, I think this only costs about $4 or $5. If you bought this, if you don't use it, it's totally, totally worthless. So let me tell you how to do it. The Bible you use for teaching, if you'll take this index and you'll put, say, a red dot or a green dot, whatever color pen you happen to have, go through your Bible, Genesis 1:1, put a red dot. Genesis 1:7, put a red dot. Genesis 1:8, it'll take you an hour or two, I know that. But then in your study Bible, you will have an indexed, color-coded way of going to the reference books that I show you from time to time, and they'll become functional on a weekly basis. Now, the other book that I mentioned to you, I hope if you're looking for a good history, and, you know, Samuel through Chronicles is history, but it's not complete history, it's theological history. And so you don't really get the facts of history that are happening in the surrounding area. From the Babylonian Chronicles and these stelae and archaeological finds and these libraries we have found archaeologically, we are able to piece together the history of the Mediterranean Tigris-Euphrates world. Now, one of the best I have seen that I think is so good, it is also extensively indexed, is A History of Israel by John Bright. And I've showed it to you several lessons, but I really hope you're going to do much study here. You need those kind of resource tools. I've really enjoyed being with you, and I hope that you have a good lesson as you apply these truths of failure to our lives today. I've enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.